The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
One of the key duties for State Treasurer Scott Fitzpatrick is investing Missouri's money. And since the state is sitting on a whole lot of cash right now, the GOP official wants voters to expand his office's investment abilities. Fitzpatrick joins the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about Missouri's financial situation and key changes to the state's low-income housing tax credit. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us, he is Missouri State Treasurer and also, I guess, the father of a newborn baby as well.
That is correct.
It is Scott Fitzpatrick. First of all, congratulations to you and your family. So I know that you are not the House Budget Chairman anymore, but whenever you come on this show, I usually ask you what the state's financial situation is. And I've been looking at some of the general revenue figures, and they seem genuinely impressive, especially compared to 2020 when the economy was kind of in a COVID-related freefall. And revenues were down across the board. Where are we as far as the state's financial situation as of July 14th, 2021?
Well, we're in really good shape, and I would say much better shape than, you know, a year and, you know, 3 months ago anybody ever thought we'd be in. And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, when you look at the revenue numbers, you know, for the fiscal year that we just got out of, and for, you know, people who aren't familiar with it, the state's fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th. And so because of COVID in 2020, the tax due date was delayed from April 15th to July 15th. And what that did was it pushed essentially the tax due date for last year into the next fiscal year. So we basically had two tax due dates in the fiscal year that we just ended. And so when you're comparing revenue figures for fiscal year 2021, which just ended on June 30th, to the prior fiscal year, it's, you know, we were up like 25% year over year. But a big chunk of that was because there was two tax due dates and compared to zero tax due dates in the prior fiscal year because it got delayed. But despite that, we did exceed the revenue estimate that the General Assembly and the governor came to. By over $1 billion. So, you know, the revenue estimate was a little over $10.2 billion, and we ended up collecting a little over $11.2 billion. So that's a sizable, increase over what we even expected. And we can actually, for the fiscal year 2022 estimate, which is the fiscal year we just began, it's July 1st of this year till June 30th of next year, the estimate that the General Assembly and the governor agreed to is $9.78 billion. So we can actually decline, our revenue in the state can decline by 13%, and we would still meet the consensus revenue estimate for this year. So that extra tax due date had a big impact.
So does that mean we have like $1 billion just sitting in the state treasury, or has that money been appropriated to certain things?
We do have a substantial surplus right now, and you have to also consider that none of that takes into account the fact that we're, you know, getting ready to receive a few $1 billion from the American Recovery Plan. That money is going to be, you know, coming soon, and will be added to that. So, I mean, we're basically in a position of, you know, basically having $1 billion more than we thought we'd have at about this time, if that makes sense. And so it's a good place to be financially. And I guess just another anecdote, you know, the treasurer's job, you know, we manage, one of the functions is we invest the money for the state. And when I took office, the amount of money that we were managing fluctuated between, you know, $3.5 to $4 billion usually. You know, that's as money would get deposited and money get spent, that amount would fluctuate. But we've been, you know, in the last year, that number has ballooned. The June 30th assets under management in the treasurer's office was $8.3 billion. So it's more than doubled in terms of the amount of cash that we're managing on a daily basis. And that includes the general revenue fund. It includes the CARES Act money that we still have left over. It includes all the other funds in the treasury, MoDOT's money, you know, all of that stuff. But that can give you kind of an idea of how much more cash we're dealing with in state government than we were dealing with a year and a half ago.
And that kind of parlays into my next question. It's an admittingly kind of a wonky question, but I think it's an important one. You mentioned that one of your jobs is investing the state's money, and part of that, you know, could conceivably be that if you have $8 billion you're managing, you want to put that money in a position where it's making money for the state that can be used for other things. Do you have everything that you need, so to speak, to invest that money to its full potential, where you could get more than what's sitting in the treasury now that could go to education, roads, et cetera?
The answer to your question is we have some options, but we have, I would say, far fewer options than a lot of state treasurer's office have in terms of how we can invest the money. And we're unique in Missouri in that our investment possibilities are confined to the Constitution. I've talked to, you know, when I go to conferences and talk to other state treasurer's offices about how they invest, they're all very surprised to hear that we're as restrictive as we are, and that restriction is in our Constitution, so much so that the General Assembly, you know, we can't even go petition the General Assembly for, you know, new investment options without the General Assembly would essentially have to pass a constitutional amendment, put it to the vote, to a vote of the people. And so we're limited. We basically can do, you know, invest in debt of the United States government, both in the form of, you know, the U.S. Treasury bonds that we hold, but also agency bonds like Fannie's and Freddie's. We can do, you know, bank deposits, which, you know, essentially we call them time deposits, which most people would know of as a CD. So we take out CDs at banks. We have the link deposit program, which is a loan program for small businesses, but the banks are taking a credit risk on that. We're just providing the capital in the form of a deposit in a bank for them to loan that out. And then I'd say the most risky thing we're currently able to do under the current law is commercial paper. And what that is, it's basically short-term unsecured corporate debt, which, you know, compared to a lot of other things that we'd like to be able to do, is probably has more risk associated with it. You know, because you're essentially, you know, they're large corporations that you're basically buying commercial paper for. That's, you're only going to be talking about, you know, the Fortune 500 type companies that have commercial paper programs that are rated high enough for us to be able to invest in them. But the point is, we can invest in that, but we cannot invest in things like municipal bonds, you know, so we can't go out and buy, you know, the debt of our municipal governments. We can't buy the debt of other state governments. And so there's some pretty significant limitations. And we also can't, you know, we can't buy equities. I don't have the power in the treasurer's office to go out and pick stocks or anything like that. And frankly, I don't, you know, when we're dealing with the state treasury, this, you know, the goal, I think, of state treasurers broadly, you know, in a priority order is safety of the investment. And then that's number one. Number two is managing liquidity. You want to make sure you have enough cash, you know, in a liquid, you know, that's liquid. You can pay the bills and make sure state government has, make sure that state government has, you know, sufficient liquidity to operate. And then the third priority is yield. And that is, you know, generating a return on the assets that can go back into the treasury to support the operation of government. And so we would like more flexibility than we have, but, you know, it's in the Constitution. And, you know, that's just kind of the world we live in.
So, yeah, I can understand why even the most aggressive treasurer may be hesitant to change the Constitution to allow you to invest some of the state's money in like mutual funds or stocks, because first of all, that money could plunge in value and you could lose a lot of money. Second of all, like, that opens up a whole wormhole of like political influence where companies, you know, could be pressuring the treasurer to invest in them. And I could understand that that has a corruption element to it. But would you want to change the Constitution to like allow you, your office, to invest in like municipal bonds or state debt?
Well, it's funny you ask, because we actually just this last legislative session worked with the legislature to pass HJR 35. And it will put a question on the ballot next year that would, if adopted, it would allow the treasurer's office to invest in municipal securities. It would also give to change the Constitution where it would allow the General Assembly to assign, you know, other prudent investment options to the treasurer's office by law. So they would give it, it would give the General Assembly the power to add to the current investment options, you know, by just passing a statute and getting the governor to sign it. And so so that actually passed, and it will be on the ballot in 2022. Yeah, to be honest, what prompted that for us was, number one, the huge influx of cash that we had been receiving, and the size of the portfolio growing substantially was one thing. And then the second thing was the interest rate environment that we're all living in. So, you know, Federal Reserve has set, you know, has set interest rates at, you know, basically zero. And so, you know, banks and, you know, the United States government have access to very cheap capital, right? It's, you know, treasuries are trading pretty much close to zero. Banks can get deposits for basically 10 basis points. And so as far as, you know, for us, those are our primary, you know, ways of investing money. And, you know, it kind of makes it challenging for us to make money under the current structure of the Constitution.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the American Rescue Act money. I think that the state is slated to get about $2.8 billion in two increments. So the state hasn't received the first increment of that yet. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're going to, I believe the current plan, and this is partially an OA function, an Office of Administration function, we're going to request that money towards the end of this month. And the reason we've delayed or waited in doing that is because the law requires us to distribute a portion of that money to what the law calls non-entitlement units, which are essentially local governments that were not large enough to receive a direct payment from the federal government of their recovery funds. And we have, there are a lot of those entities in the state of Missouri. And so we needed time to basically get everybody set up to, you know, to make sure we had all the questions answered that we need to get answered from the federal government, and prepare to get those payments made. Because you only get, once we receive the funding from the federal government, we only have 30 days to make that those payments to local governments. And so we didn't want to request the money, you know, get it in the treasury and not be prepared to get those payments made within the 30-day timeframe set out by law.
So this is a kind of a basic question, and I sometimes like to break complicated issues down. When your office receives a $1.4 billion check, like, how do you get that money and what do you do with it?
So it's generally on that type of a, so that size of a receipt coming in from the federal government, we receive a wire transfer. And so when we received the CARES Act money, you know, one interesting thing that people may not know, and it also may not be that interesting to most people, but we're required to collateralize all of our deposits in banks, meaning the bank, if the amount of money we have in a bank exceeds FDIC insurance limit, which is only $250,000, then that bank is required to provide us with collateral with a face value equal to the amount of the uninsured deposit. Or it's actually 102% of the amount of the uninsured deposit. So they have to pledge us treasury bonds, or they have to give us a letter of credit from the Federal Home Loan Bank or something that we can hold. That way, if there's a bank failure, we have some, you know, the taxpayers aren't just out the money. And so, you know, when you're talking about $1 billion, there aren't a ton of banks that are really, especially right now, really excited to receive $1 billion from us that they then have to turn around and pledge collateral against. And so when we got the CARES Act money, we didn't know. I was actually on a call, a conference call with other state treasurers. We were trying to get answers out of Treasury about when that money was going to be coming down because of the collateral requirements. We wanted to be prepared for it. And while I was on that call, the Alabama treasurer had just gotten notified by his staff that they had just gotten their money. And like by the end of the call, like four or five states had gotten their money. And so we were basically, we worked with, in that case, it was Wells Fargo. They pledged collateral basically in advance because we were concerned that the money was going to show up late in the day when it was too late for us to actually collateralize that deposit. And so they pledged collateral to us in advance, and we had the money directed to Wells Fargo. And it was a good thing we did that, because when we got a $1 billion wire that showed up at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So if that would have happened and we hadn't had the collateral in place, we would have had to have rejected the wire, sent it back to them, and tried again at a later date.
That would have been probably very annoying, to say the least. One thing the legislature is going to be doing over the next several months is deciding where this American Rescue money should go. Is your office going to be providing some guidance about what that money can and can't be spent on? Or do you think that the legislature is going to be able to figure that out on their own?
So we're going to continue to host basically all the information that comes out of Treasury on, you know, about the use of this money, just like we did for the CARES Act. We're going to continue to host that information on a website that we have that is mainly going to be a tool for local governments to look to try to figure out, you know, how they can spend this money. We were very involved with the local governments on the CARES Act side. We fielded a lot of questions and tried to help people understand the rules and associated with that money. On the state side, with the CARES Act money, the legislature gave a very broad appropriation to the, you know, to the Office of Administration or the Department of Public Safety for the spending of the CARES Act money. It was very non-prescriptive. There was not a lot of direction given by the legislature. It was just like, here's an appropriation to spend the CARES Act money basically for, you know, for COVID-related, you know, expenses. And so most of those decisions were made at, you know, on an executive branch level in terms of how that money was going to get spent. There was the working group that I chaired that was involved on the front end with quite a bit of that. But by and large, most of the decisions ended up being made by the governor's office and, you know, the executive branch, essentially. My guess is that the legislature will probably take a more active role with this American Recovery Plan money. And they have really capable staff in the legislature that will help kind of educate and brief the members of the Budget Committee and the Senate Appropriations Committee on what the allowable uses of that money is. We'll obviously be available to be a resource if anybody needs us to, you know, if the legislature were to ask for our help and you know, dissecting any of that guidance or anything, you know, to help them kind of figure out how they want to appropriate that money. But my guess is that the legislature will be a little bit more prescriptive with this new money coming in than they were with the CARES Act money that came in last year.
We'll be right back after this short break with State Treasurer Scott Fitzpatrick.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Treasurer Scott Fitzpatrick. He is a Republican who was just elected to his first full term in office. So, one of the things we often talk with you about on this program is the low-income housing tax credit. You've been pretty heavily involved in efforts to revamp how that credit works on the Missouri Housing Development Commission, which you are a member. And I saw a press release recently about a change to the program that seemed quite interesting as somebody who has followed the debate over the incentive for a long time. Talk about what the commission has done and how do you think it will make this incentive more cost effective for the state?
Yeah, well, I mean, as a little bit of background would be, you know, the state credit had been criticized by, you know, state auditors and tax credit commissions for a long time for basically being inefficient and the state getting very little in return for the tax credit dollars that it was spending on low-income housing. And so obviously in 2017, the program got shut down when Governor Greitens was in office. And after that, there was a couple of years where the legislature tried to pass some reforms, some stuff passed the House, but couldn't get past the Senate, some stuff passed the Senate, but got changed in the House. And ultimately the legislature was unsuccessful at changing the program statutorily. And so after a couple of years of that, the governor decided he wanted to try to, and the several members of the legislature asked the commission to try to do what they could from an administrative standpoint within the confines of existing law to make the program more efficient, to make it run better. And so I took a heavy interest in that because I was also very interested in trying to get legislation passed. And since we were unable to do that, refocused on what we could do to improve the program at the commission level, you know, as a member of the commission. And we focused on, you know, a couple of things. Number one is transparency. And the program has been criticized for a long time for being, you know, an insider program that, you know, nobody understood who got how people got the projects picked and how projects got awarded. And so it bred kind of a perception of that it was a corrupt program and that people were, you know, getting favors and things like that. And to me, the best way to solve problems like that is always to make it transparent, make the decision-making process transparent, as transparent as possible. And so the first thing we did was we put in place a scoring system so that everybody knows exactly what metrics or what things that staff is looking at to determine whose project is going to get selected. And yes, there is some subjectivity into that, and, you know, because I mean, a lot of the categories are just, frankly, they're just subjective, and that just, there's nothing you can really do about that. But you can at least see how staff is scoring those projects on every category. And then there's a list of every project, how those projects scored and which ones got selected. And I think that's helped pretty substantially. Now, some people don't like the score they get, but I think it's at least helped people understand, you know, how the decisions are made and what the process is. And then it's not about, you know, as a politician putting pressure on staff to pick a deal or something like that.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of like when former Auditor Schweik put like a excellent, good, fair, bad, poor system on some of the audits. Like it was summarizing a lot of what the work was, but it kind of made it more understandable to people that are following the issue. I'm sure it's not exactly the same like structurally, but it seems conceptually like a very similar idea. But continue.
Yeah, and I think that's right. So we focused on that, transparency being, you know, is something I've always been a proponent of from my time in the legislature to my time as treasurer and, you know, on MHCC and so on and so forth. But the other thing we wanted to do was we wanted to improve what the state was getting for its investment, because, you know, the way the program has worked, it's essentially works like we're giving somebody a tax credit or tax credits that are redeemable over 10 years in exchange for that individual providing low-income housing. And because they can't get that money in full for 10 years, they can't give us, you know, a dollar, you know, they can't give us a dollar's worth of housing for a dollar's worth of tax credit, because there's cost of capital, right? There's basically the cost of money. And so we were looking at how can we improve this? Because basically at its best, the state was getting about 50 cents of housing for every dollar that we were spending on this tax credit program, which I think by and large is a, you know, bad deal for a AAA credit rated state that has a cost of borrowing money. We could go borrow the money and build it ourselves for a much lower interest rate than that. And at its worst, back in the early days of this program, we were getting like 25 cents worth of housing for every dollar we were spending. And so the goal was, how can we get that up? How can we get that number up? And so we looked at the program, and one of the things that the legislature proposed, and it was, I think, agreeable on both sides of the House and the Senate, was that we should spend less money on this program. We were spending $160 million a year on it. and which was tied to basically how much we were also getting from the federal government for the program. And so what we did is we took that down to 70%. So we're only going to do 70% at the state level of what the federal government is doing in low-income housing, which is still a lot. You know, Kansas, for instance, doesn't even have a state low-income housing program. They only run the federal part of that program. They don't even put state money into it. So for us to do 70% of what the federal government is doing is a lot. So we went ahead and went with 70%, but because we were doing less than the federal credit, you know, the law requires us to do this credit over 10 years. Okay. But because we were doing less than 100% of the federal credit, what we were able to do was issue a portion of those tax credits. I guess I should say a portion of the projects we issued the tax credits where they were getting more of the tax credits earlier in the 10-year period. And then in the outer years, the later years of that credit, they were getting, you know, a reduced amount of tax credits. So it was still the same amount of credits over the whole life of the deal, but they were just getting a larger amount in the early years, and they were getting a smaller amount in the later years of the credits of the 10-year credit stream.
Right. And I was going to say that probably means that the people that get the credits can sell those credits on the front end for more money, and that would save the state money over at least it would probably save the state money since they're more valuable. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're right, because what's happening is the state's issuing these tax credits, or the commission is issuing these tax credits to developers. Those developers need cash to build the housing. So what they have to do is they have to turn around and get investors to basically buy these tax credits. It's not exactly buying the tax credits, but it's essentially they're buying these tax credits from the developer. And since the developer is selling the credits to an investor, the investor wants to have a return on their investment, right? They're using it to offset tax liability, but some of that tax liability can't be offset for 10 years. And so they want to earn a return on that money while they wait 10 years to redeem that tax credit. And so by giving them access to the credits earlier, you know, that they can pay more for them because they're not having to sit on them as long before they can redeem them. And so, yeah, you're right. So by allowing a larger portion of the credits to come earlier in that 10-year period, the developers are able to sell those credits for more money. And we wanted to do it, you know, as a pilot program for the first year, because we wanted to compare how those credits sold in terms of the pricing compared to the credits that were just distributed equally over that 10-year period. And what we found is that the credits that were what we call accelerated, where there were more credits available in the earlier years, sold for like 18% more than the credits that were distributed equally over that 10-year period. And so we were getting almost 70 cents on the dollar for the credits that were accelerated versus high 50. I think we're getting 68 or 69 cents for the accelerated credits and like 57.5 cents for the standard credits. And what that results in, if you look at it on across the entire program, is if we had done the whole program that way, we could have built an additional 86 units without spending any more money over the life of the program just by doing this accelerated credit model. And so with what we did is we had a committee that of the board that basically was tasked with evaluating the success or failure of this pilot program. And what we found by looking at the data was, you know, number one, that it was obviously successful because it drove pricing on the credits up by 18%. So what we did with that information was came up with a recommendation to allow now up to 50% of the credits. We wanted to get one more year of data. We thought that the data we had warranted increasing the amount of the credits that were available in this accelerated form from the 20% that we started with last year up to 50% for this year. But we wanted to get one more year of data under our belt and make sure that kind of experience holds again for another year. And I think, so what you're referring to is we essentially as a committee voted to recommend to the full commission that program be expanded. And so hopefully what that means is we'll have more low-income housing for without spending any more money, you know, in the LIHTC program.
So one of the things we've talked about on this program is how difficult it can be to instill changes in this tax credit. You mentioned before that there was an effort to pass some changes into statute through the legislative process, which kind of crashed and burned in spectacular fashion. Why do you think that there was consensus of doing something like this when maybe 5 or 10 years ago, this would have been pretty difficult to see actually happen?
Well, I think it's the culture of the Missouri Housing Development Commission, I think, has changed radically in the last couple of years. You know, when I first got to the commission, it was almost even like frowned upon to ask a question, you know, at the commission meetings, much less suggest a change to anything that the staff suggested. And that to me was kind of crazy, as coming from the legislature and, you know, where your job is to ask questions and suggest changes. And so, I mean, you know, I got pretty engaged on that front. And I think what it did is it kind of helped other commissioners because we've had new commissioners appointed, and the makeup of the commission now, I think, is really good. We got a lot of smart people on the commission from all over the state. And most of them are, you know, not politicians, right? They're people who are volunteering their time to serve on this commission. And so they're not looking at this through the lens of, am I going to make a particular developer mad? Am I going to make, you know, some tax credit syndicator mad? They're looking at it, what makes sense for the program? What makes sense for the taxpayers? And, you know, as a result of that, looking at the data, you know, we've gotten to a point now where lots of commissioners, or, you know, pretty much all the commissioners, are willing and able to suggest changes to staff recommendations. It happens much more frequently now. But we've also, as a commission, you know, and particularly the study group, when we looked at the data, there was some political pressure from some people that don't like this model of how the tax credits are issued, but it didn't work. I mean, in terms of what happened with this committee, it was a unanimous vote amongst the members of the committee to make this recommendation to the full board, that we go to 50% of this, of the credit or the program being run like this. And I think that's just kind of a reflection of the confidence that the commissioners have to do what's right and to not worry about the politics around it.
Has the full MHDC voted on this proposal, or is that going to happen in the subsequent weeks and months ahead?
So tomorrow, I guess it might be today, I guess, when this airs, is the meeting of the Housing Development Commission, where we will go over the draft QAP, which is the Qualified Allocation Plan. And that's essentially the document that the board approves to put out to the public for comment on how this program is going to be run for the upcoming year. And so it'll actually take place, on the 15th of July, which is, I guess, tomorrow or today, depending on how you want to look at it, you know, when this is released or when this is aired. So probably by the time a lot of people listen to this, the board will have voted on it as a whole. But a majority of the board, so I think we've got 10 people on MHDC, and there were 6 people on the committee, and it passed unanimously out of the committee. So unless somebody on the committee were to change their mind and all the members who weren't on the committee were against this recommendation, then it would, you know, it would seemingly be adopted as part of the QAP.
My last question for you before I let you go, there has been some talk that you may be on the ballot in some form in 2022, either for the soon-to-be-open state auditor race, U.S. Senate, Congress, Berry County Recorder of Deeds, you know, stuff like that. I do have to ask, are you thinking of running for something in 2022?
Well, you're right that we have, an auditor's race and a Senate race, and I think both of those are very important. And I've enjoyed being a part of the process of helping Republicans take over statewide offices and maintain super majorities in the legislature. And so I've obviously, you know, I've been considering how I could be involved in 2022. And what I'll tell you is that probably in the next several days that you'll see a decision one way or the other on what that will look like for me.
One thing we like on the Politically Speaking podcast is a good cliffhanger and good foreshadowing.
Go.
Mr. Treasurer, thank you so much for joining me today for all of our stories, stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How could people follow you or any other aspects of the Treasurer's Office on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
You can go to at Fitzpatrick Mo on Twitter. I think it's at Mo Treasurer on Twitter for the official office. And then on Facebook, I literally just have to search myself to find myself. So just Scott Fitzpatrick or Missouri State Treasurer, and you'll find everything you need to know.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.